All right, guys, today we're going to be talking about Bitcoin. And specifically in my mind, I'm thinking that you get the phone call from the 26-year-old. They've never made another investment before. They have their first $10,000 saved up from their job, and they want to know, hey, man, I've really been thinking about going all in on Bitcoin. What do you think? Should I buy it? And the short answer is no. Mic drop.
You're listening to Choose FI Radio. The blueprint for financial independence lives here. If you're looking to unlock the secrets to financial independence and early retirement, you're in the right place. Stay tuned and join a community of like-minded people who are getting off the hamster wheel and taking control of their lives in the pursuit of financial independence. Choose FI, your home for financial independence online.
I've been teasing this for a while. We are bringing Miles back on the show. We're going to be talking about crypto today, both from utility perspective, but also where it fits into the speculation investment arena for the FI community. As he's kind of ridden that wave more than anybody could really ever have hoped for, I think he has a very unique perspective. This has the potential to be a very polarizing episode. So Brad, myself, and Miles realized this at the very beginning. I think I initially set it up to say that there were going to be like three episodes in Bitcoin. There's not going to be three episodes on Bitcoin. This is the Bitcoin episode for the Choose FI Radio podcast. And what totally convinced me that I had the right person to talk about it was an email that I got from Miles basically saying, guys, I get that this is a polarizing issue, but I really don't want this to be a Floyd Money Mayweather at the MGM type fight, more of an intelligent and controlled discussion. And I was like, yes, that is exactly it. This is an exploratory mission where we get to hear about someone that stumbled into it and has benefited from it both as a utility and as a speculative investment. I think it hits all of the criteria you could ever hope for. But for the FI community, through the very focused lens of FI, here is your Bitcoin podcast. And to help me with this, I have my co-host Brad here with me today. How you doing, buddy?
I'm doing well, Jonathan. Yeah, I think that was a good intro because anytime you hear anything about Bitcoin or cryptocurrency, the people line up on either side, right? And it can get kind of messy. And that is not what we are about here at Choose FI in any way. This is not, let's have Miles on and pepper him with awful questions and make him, you know, squirm. That's not it at all. Miles is a member of our community. He happened to have gotten into Bitcoin early, like you said, for the utility purpose, which is so fascinating. Sure, he's made some money on paper in the intervening time, but that's what's so interesting about it. We get the full perspective. And I'm just here, I'd love to ask Miles some questions, and I think it should be a fun conversation. So with that, Miles, welcome back to Choose FI.
Thank you, gentlemen. Good to be back. Let's go for it.
So Miles, it's obvious that with this, more than with any other podcast, the place to start is the beginning. And what I mean by that is, what series of events led you to stumble onto cryptocurrency, and I guess in particular, in your case, Bitcoin?
Well, I'm a software developer by trade. I've always been that, and I exited the employment world, I guess, in the 90s. And I went off on my own to develop my own software, as, you know, developers do. And this is a long time ago. Back in those days, you used to write software and you'd put it on a CD and send it out to people, or you might have it on a website and they could download it and then buy a license to it. It was those old days. It wasn't the days that we have today. What happened was I developed some software for a market in the late 90s. It was for the service and repair industry. I had to get this software to market very quickly because there wasn't anybody in the competing space where I was looking to deploy my application. So I did it in a language I wasn't all that comfortable using, but it was quick. You know, I could get this thing to market fast. And as it happened, it worked out really well. I had a product that people wanted to buy. This happened to traverse into the, you know, early 2000s and ongoing. By about 2003, I started to see the downside of the technology choices I'd made earlier on, and I had to get this software redeveloped. So here is my problem. I've got 200 clients. I've got this active application that's been quite successful. And now I've got to rewrite the thing from scratch because I was losing all of my money paying license fees to the language licensing that I'd used on this thing. I just had to rewrite it. So here I am, just me, effectively a micro business running this software and doing okay. somehow I've got to run my business and I've got to redevelop the software from scratch. It's a tall order. And I knew that I had to reach out to other people who could help me do this. But affording local programmers at the time was really difficult. My margins were very low, mainly because I was losing most of my money to this licensing issue. I ended up having to go offshore to find developers. And I chose a different technology structure to do it in. I went to the Asian market to look to who would actually be able to be affordable that could work with me and could teach me this alternative technology at the same time, partner with me to get this thing done. And I had a hard time finding somebody, but eventually I found a guy who was in Bangladesh, which is a really unusual place, but the technology choice we had gone with was very unique and I really had very few choices to make with this. Anyway, I could afford this guy. So what happened was I put him on retainer and he started working with me and we ended up rewriting the software and transformed it, did the whole thing. Took us a couple of years, but every 2 weeks, he was like kind of like an employee, but really an outsourced, you know, contractor. Every 2 weeks, I got to pay the guy. He would send me kind of an invoice, you know, every 2 weeks. And then I'd go, okay, well, how can I pay you? Now, by the time this all sort of became very difficult, we were getting into 2005, sometime around then. It started off that the only way to pay him was to use Western Union. So I contacted Western Union and I said, look, I'm a company. I want to pay this guy. How do I do it? Initially, they said, okay, sign up on their website, put some money in this account, pay the guy. I'm thinking, fine. So what does pay the guy mean? Well, it means they'll give you an ID number. This, I think they called it an MTN or something like that. And you'd email it to him and then he would take that ID number to his local Western Union office and then present it with his ID. And then two days later or something like that, he'd get his money, less all the fees that he would have to pay on his end to collect. And I was also paying fees on my end to originate it. It was getting to the point where fees were ridiculous, but it was workable because he was so cheap. So in the end, that's what I did. So what happened was about a year or so later, Western Union started to change their policies, particularly in regards to Bangladesh. Now, it was post 9/11, post Patriot Act. This was a time that certain countries were very sensitive to the United States. And Bangladesh being a predominantly Muslim country, which ranked on sort of a higher level of risk on the terrorism category, was very, very hard to send money to. So little by little, Western Union made it more and more difficult for me to pay my guy. And as time had progressed, he's more and more important to me to be on the payroll. So I'm thinking, this is getting ridiculous. They made it to the point where I literally, in order to pay him, and this, I had to do this every 2 weeks, I'd have to go to my bank, pull cash out to cover his costs and the Western Union fees, get in my car, drive to the local supermarket, go to the customer service counter, front up there with the cash, give them all of his details, originate the payment, pay them the cash to get the MTM number to drive back to email to him so he could go and collect it. And this was happening every 2 weeks. It was ridiculous. I then said to my bank, there's got to be another way I can do it. And they said, like, well, you could wire transfer. So we tried that for a while. So it started out wire transferring cost me $35 to wire. But after time went by, it was not something that I could do automatically. I still had to get in the car every 2 weeks, go to the bank, do the whole thing. And it was just getting ridiculous. As time progressed and we got through to around about, I guess it was 2011, something like that, all of a sudden I started questioning whether keeping this guy on payroll, for lack of a better term, made sense. I'd already achieved what we needed to do with the software. We ended up going off in another direction, doing some internet stuff as well, in which he was not participating in. And I had him kind of there to help me out with maintenance and to be there. And I knew this guy was talented and I knew this guy could deliver on other things, but he was just so much less attractive to use because of the hoops that I had to personally jump through to pay him. And at the end of the day, I questioned whether or not to keep him. I said to him, look, I don't think this is going to work out because I cannot pay you because of all of these obstacles that you have nothing. It's not your fault and it's not my fault. It's just the way it is. So a week goes by and he contacts me back and he goes, listen, I might have an alternative solution. I'm like, well, what is it? He goes, have you ever heard of Bitcoin? And I'm like, well, not really. This is about 2011. I knew a little bit about what was going on in the cypherpunk movement and, you know, the underpinnings of some of the technology circles, but it wasn't anything I'd actually used before. Anyway, he says, look, I don't want to lose your business. So here's what we're going to do. I'm going to help you set up an account on an exchange. You send them the money and then you wire or you send me my payment out in Bitcoin every 2 weeks, just as we've done before. So I said, well, I guess it can't hurt, right? I mean, I'm having to pay wire fees to get the money to you. I may as well pay wire fees to get the money to an exchange. And so he sets me up with this exchange called Mt. Gox. It was in Japan. Basically, it was kind of like a web thing. It was kind of like an online banking portal almost, and you'd wire them the money, and it took ages for them to actually receive and credit you for the money. But once the money was there, you would then have access to these funds, but in this Bitcoin thing, and then I would convert his payment into US dollars, work out what he was doing it, and then I would send Bitcoin to him. And that's where it all began. And that was about, I think it was somewhere around about mid-2011, something like that.
This is fascinating because this is honestly, of all the conversations I've had about Bitcoin over the last year, this is actually the first conversation I've had, at least here in the States, about someone referring to their actual utilization. Every other conversation I've had has been tied to the fear of missing out about what happens when it's worth 1,000 times more than when you initially bought it. But utility makes sense to me. You have a problem. Here is a solution. And it's more appealing to me because I have family from Africa, from the country of Zimbabwe, with 90%+ unemployment. I mean, essentially, it's a country in crisis where there are no functioning businesses. There are entrepreneurs that are making things work at the margins. And one of the ways that they can still get paid because the government is just inefficient is through these type of cryptocurrencies and online monetary exchange programs. And so I see the utility there, but I never hear anybody talking about it that way in my own social circle.
Well, it was to me an alternative to PayPal because PayPal didn't have, there's a term I got used to back in those days, and it's probably still appropriate. It's called reciprocal banking agreement. And it basically means that that country is on the bad list to deal with. PayPal, for example, does not allow you to send money to somebody in Bangladesh, even to this day, because there is no reciprocal banking agreement that allows you to do that. They would get in trouble, apparently, if they were to do that. And so, whereas I can go on PayPal and send you money and you get it pretty much instantly and, you know, with a couple of days it's in your bank, I can't do that to a guy in Bangladesh. I would have a hard time doing that to somebody in, I guess at one point I had a couple of guys in Vietnam I was dealing with, and that was a problem with them. And as more regions become part of the emerging digital economy, this becomes more and more of a problem. And they all turn to alternative ways of being paid. And it just so happens Bitcoin was one of the first ones in that space.
Miles, I'm curious, how did you determine how much in Bitcoin to send your contractor every 2 weeks? Did you peg it to some type of traditional currency? Or was it just, we have a contract for X percent of a Bitcoin every 2 weeks? Like, how did that work? And I guess if you could, do you think you would still pay a contractor in Bitcoin today based on volatility?
I actually do still pay one of my contractors in Bitcoin today. He's in the Philippines. But in answer to your question, when you went online with Mt. Gox, you could choose to work out the equivalent of the current US dollar version to Bitcoin. So if you said, I want to send 200 US dollars, it would do the calculation for you. You didn't even think about it. It would just say, well, you know, you need to send whatever the Bitcoin, you know, exchange rate was at the time. You need to send this amount of money. And there was a fee that they would take in addition. And it works much the same these days with sites like Coinbase. If you want to send money from Coinbase, you can put in the US dollar amount and it will work out the Bitcoin to extract from your account.
Okay, that makes sense. So for your current one, and that's a really cool answer. I was not expecting that. So for the current contractor that you're using, that you're paying with Bitcoin, like, do you do that just like as a spot amount? Like when you see Bitcoin changing in price, if you will, based on US dollars by a couple $1,000 a day. Sometimes you see these fluctuations. Do you just do it? Hey, this is what it's worth at this exact moment. Do you do like, I mean, as ridiculous as it sounds, like an average of the prior week? Like that to me is one of the limitations of it, is it does jump up and down so much. How do you know what you're paying?
What I do with my current contractor is that I pay him a couple hundred dollars a week to do some work for me. So every Monday I have to write him a payment. So what I do at that point is I go into Coinbase and I say, okay, I need $200 plus their fees, let's say 220, for example. My Coinbase account is tied to my bank account. So I'll go to Coinbase and say, okay, extract $220 or something similar from my bank account in real time. And it immediately credits my wallet in Coinbase. And then I go to Coinbase and I go, send $200 US to this person's Bitcoin address. And it works out the Bitcoin amount, extracts it from my wallet. And because that is done literally within like 10 minutes of each other, the price fluctuation doesn't affect me. So it's purely a payment rail. It's got absolutely no, you know, savings or persistence. The persistence stuff came as a result of me being inquisitive as to what Bitcoin was. That happened later. But I see things in kind of like a checking and a savings account metaphor. The checking account is the liquidity that I use to do transactions using cryptocurrency. And I don't just use Bitcoin. I mean, I use other currencies as well. But for the most part, that's kind of like the checking account. But separate to that, just as good FI people would do, I save as much as possible in crypto. And I use that as a separate savings facility. And that's done offline.
Okay, no, that certainly makes sense. And if you don't mind, can we just take a step back and talk about Coinbase? Because I've heard that terminology a lot. And I understand there's some type of exchange. How safe are they? Like, I think that's one of my concerns. Like, if I were to purchase Bitcoin or any other cryptocurrency, who am I sending money to? How do I know that this is legitimate? You know, Coinbase, you hear all the time. So I'm assuming of any of these exchanges, it's the quote unquote most legitimate. But how do I even know that I'm buying anything? What backs it up? And the answer might be the blockchain, dummy. You know, what is Coinbase? What do they exactly do? How quickly can you get in and out? And what fees do you pay?
Okay, well, Coinbase is kind of like an online bank account. When you see the user experience, that's how it comes across. What they are is that they are what they call an exchange. They're also what they call a wallet. They're two different things, but they package it all together in one thing. You apply to Coinbase to be a customer, and you have to go through the traditional banking KYC AML process. That's know your customer, anti-money laundering for those that are into acronyms. And basically, you have to be identified. And they'll do things like they get you to take a photo with your driver's license, you know, so they can see you are who you are. And they can only deal with certain regions. So you have to prove that you're within scope of their region and so on. But once you've done that and you've got a Coinbase account, then you link a bank account to it. And then you can transfer from your bank account into their bank account effectively. But just like a foreign exchange transaction would occur when you were, say, buying euro or you're buying yen or whatever it might be from US dollar, you'll do a foreign exchange transfer into your cryptocurrency of choice. Coinbase allow you to use multiple different currencies, but they're probably most famous and probably the bulk of their transactions are done in pure Bitcoin. They were one of the very early exchanges in the United States to get approved as a regulated exchange, in that they are, you know, they ticked all the boxes with the Financial Crimes and Enforcement Network and Department of Treasury and IRS and everything like that. Although their relationship with those agencies has always been at odds somewhat, they were allowed to be a regulated exchange. And in addition to that, they were able to obtain insurance in the same way that, say, a banking account has FDIC insurance. So if the bank gets robbed, you know, you're covered. Coinbase have similar insurance for their customers as well. So it acts kind of like a bank, but you just don't visit it. You just go on a website and you know, transfer money to it. It converts it into Bitcoin. It'll hold it for you. And then from it, you can send it to other parties. That's one case. I would say from a safety point of view, I'm a firm believer that when it comes to cryptocurrencies in any form, you should hold your own private keys and not rely on an exchange to hold them for you. But I'm one of those tin hat paranoid crazy people. However, I've seen exchanges get hacked. And if you don't want to be subject to that, that we could do a whole other show on how to secure your coins. But suffice to say, hardware wallets, look them up. They're a good thing.
What's interesting about this conversation to this point is we have been discussing Bitcoin as actually being used as a currency. I think probably one of the cases that people do make and that I tend to agree with is that when you hear the hype, it's usually based around how valuable it's going to be a year, 2 years from now, and you can't afford to miss out on this. But as a currency, there are a few different bullet points that currencies need to provide. And one, I think you covered, actually, you were saying that it was a solution to a transaction that was very difficult. In order for you to exchange money internationally, there's a problem there. So this is as close to easy as there is up to this point. The second bullet point would be that it would need to be widely accepted. In your case, widely accepted isn't as big of a deal as much as two individuals trading value back and forth. And then the third one is the stability of that. And that's the part that Brad was landing on. And it's also something that I want to come back to, because it sounded like to me, when you were saying that you were paying these individuals, you are actually investing new dollars from a bank account to pay them directly, not cashing in your currency that has been, I guess, persistent or growing up to this point. Did I understand that correctly?
Yes, that is correct. To complete the circle with the, as far as holding Bitcoins, when I learned about Bitcoin in 2011 and I realized that this was a successful way to pay this contractor, my immediate reaction, which is somewhat naive, but my immediate reaction was, well, if it works for him, it would work for other contractors, and I could build an army of developers here and we could go and do great things and change the world. That's really naive, because what I didn't do, and it took me a while to work this out, was to look at exactly what was going on with this currency and then to see all of the ripple effects that it has. What I didn't realize was that this was like a virtual economy that was kind of similar to old video games when you would buy like Second Life or all of those massive video games that were around or still are, like World of Warcraft and stuff, where people were trading digital goods between each other. Somebody wanted to buy somebody's sword, or you want to get virtual gold in a game, or you need a shield or something. And, you know, there were people a long time ago, not so much these days, who used to play these games 24/7 in China, build up all of these things you would want, and then sell them to you for real dollars. And that's actually the underlying reason why Mt. Gox as an exchange began, is to be able to allow the transaction of digital goods between people, and realizing that if you're an avatar in a video game, how are you going to trust that fictitious character to complete the transaction if there was not a third-party exchange between you and the player? And when I started seeing this and realizing, hang on, this is really interesting, because what this is creating is like a simulation of real money and real economies, because the value of things would ebb and flow based on supply and demand. And there was always the factor of inflation or deflation that could come into it. And I started realizing these guys have created a laboratory simulation of economics. Now, at the same time, and this is why it was very interesting timing, we had just gone through 2008, through the global financial crisis. People had lost their homes. People had their trust in banks was an all-time low. They saw banks as casinos that were out there to rip them off and steal their wealth. And to some degree, that was true. But the thing is, there was no trust. What happened was a lot of people who were activists, hackers, cryptographers, in that sort of group, wanted to use their knowledge as a weapon against the banks. They wanted to create a way in which they could decentralize a trust, and that they could create a method in which they could decentralize trust that would go against the banks completely. And they did that with Bitcoin, the whole concept of the blockchain, the whole concept of cryptography used as almost as a weapon against the banks was really what spawned this, and probably is one of the great reasons why there is so much of a polarizing effect when people talk about Bitcoin. It's because Bitcoin was originally a weapon. It wasn't just a currency. It was a way to stick it to the banks because they just stole my neighbor's house or they just put this guy into bankruptcy. You know, this was how we fought back. And to some degree, that was true. But what was really interesting was that when you create a virtual new economy, then all of the problems that we've dealt with for thousands of years since the dawn of money as an exchange start coming to the surface all over again. How do you trust between two parties? How do you transfer and trust that, you know, how do you stop a thing called double spending, where if I give you something, I don't give it to somebody else, and then you both some point realize, hey, who's got the real thing? This is the underpinning concepts of in technology of mining and all that technical stuff, which, you know, that would blow people's minds and bore them into tears, I would think. But and they can go to YouTube and find out all about the technology of this stuff. But in solving those problems, the Bitcoin community created opportunities in so many other areas. And that would be the blockchain and what it can do for all these things. But you know what? I'm going to be selfish here. I always looked at this and go, well, that's all wonderful and good, but what's in it for me? How do I make money? And then I looked at this and I realized, you know, if this is an asset and it's going to go up in value because it has scarcity, there are only 21 million Bitcoins that can ever be produced, then the supply and demand curve has to kick in at some point. And I can get in really, 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 really cheap. So I did that. I grabbed a bunch of it and I stuck it away and I said, well, I'm not going to use that for trading. I'll use this for trading and have like a separate run. I'll just keep that stuff aside and I'll use it. And periodically, I would delve into it to use it to pay somebody if I couldn't be bothered going to the bank or transferring money or whatever. But for the most part, I just left it there. And over the time from about 2011 through to about, I'm going to say like 2014, 2015, Bitcoin was kind of like the sleeping giant. You know, it was there. Prices went up a little bit, down a little bit. It was good. Don't get me wrong. I mean, it was better than, you know, betting on wheat futures or something. I mean, it was good. But there were certain fundamental points when the price went crazy. Like people all of a sudden got religion and wanted to go down this path. And then Bitcoin went from like $30 to $1,200 really fast. And everyone thought, oh, man, this is great. We're on to, we're going to all be millionaires. This is wonderful. And then what happened? It crashed. I looked at it and I thought, yeah, but fundamentally, it's got an application that I can use. And fundamentally, it makes sense. So what did I do? I bought it on the downside. So I'd be buying the dip. And I then, at about $180, I bought a ton more. And I'm telling all my friends, you've got to get in on this thing. This thing's awesome. Look, it could transform the world. You can stick it to the banks. You can do, you know, and they're all going, go away, Miles. You know, you're annoying. Go away. I'm like, oh, okay. Well, you know, that was the message back in, I guess, 2014 or something. And eventually I would, you know, no one seemed to understand this thing. So I'd go out on a plane and I'd visit these conferences. You know, there was these Bitcoin conferences, digital money conferences. And I'd hear people of like mind talking about all this stuff. And then I realized, you know, we're all seeing this for what it is. And so we all got in and just rode out through the difficult times and stayed in and kept the faith, you know, all the way through. And at some point, I kind of looked at it and I said, well, yeah, I mean, it's pretty good and the price is great and everything and I get it. And then 2017 happened. And when 2017 happened, it was like the real estate craziness of the early 2000s when everybody wanted to buy any form of rental property they could get their hands on because they knew it was going to go up in value. We could make five times our money on this. And every TV show had flipped this whatever and, you know, all that sort of stuff was going on. And it was just that boom bust mentality, that lottery winning mentality that is so subcultured in the United States. And all of a sudden I got really, I don't know, what's the word for it? Jaded, I guess. I saw people who had no idea about the technologies, had no idea about the fundamentals, had no idea about the economics, had no idea about history, get in on this thing and try and sell this bill of goods to the rest of the world like it was an Amway program or something. at that point, I just turned away from it. And I said, you know what? I've got a stash of this. I'm just going to leave it alone. But when people come to me and say, you know, I saw this thing about Bitcoin on the news, or, hey, should I be buying Bitcoin? Because they're talking about it on CNBC or whatever. I'm like, you know, really go away. At this point, 2 years ago, I tried to tell you that this might be something. And at that point, I was the kook you didn't want to hear. And now you want to hear. And it's not that I'm jaded, because that's what people want. I said, you're asking me for all the wrong reasons. This is not an investment. This is not your retirement account. This is not your path to FI. This is speculation like a penny stock. And right now, the penny stock just made, you know, got to $5 or $10. And all of a sudden, it's a real thing and you want in on it. And I said, I'm not going to be in a position where I can tell you what the future looks like. I can tell you that the spin-off from this technology in terms of blockchain and everything that was going on, particularly in areas like Ethereum and some of those areas, that's really interesting. And technologically, that's brilliant. And we're going to see some enormous benefit to the world. But I'm not sure how much of that could be monetized. But what I can tell you is the Bitcoin, which, you know, in January 2017 was $1,000, that today is like $10,000. You know what? I'm sorry, that train's come and gone. If you want to get into Bitcoin now and you've got $10,000 burning a hole in your pocket, well, good luck to you, but be prepared to lose it, because it's not Bitcoin is wrong. It's not technology is bad. It's not that the reasons why it exists is good. It's because this crazy herd of people who came into this market and blew it up like a helium balloon for something that it isn't, have come in and destroyed the underlying fabric of this. And consequently, and recently, I know there was the blog article on Mr. Money Mustache about Bitcoin just recently. When I read that, I'm like, hallelujah, thank you for saying that, because it's so true. People are getting in this thing and going, I can make millions of dollars in this. And I'm like, no. How about you spend some time researching it and reading it and understanding it, and don't come to me and have me, you know, tell you how you're going to get from zero to hero. That's not my job. It's your job to work it out. And when you do that, if you have questions, I'm happy to answer the questions technically, but this is not going to be, I don't think it's the internet.com boom thing where I could invest in Amazon and it's 1997. No. That train has come and gone, left the station. Now we're looking at the future and whether or not this is going to be a part of the new economy. And in that world, I have doubts. Not completely doubtful, and I'm going to annoy everybody in the Bitcoin community or everybody in the crypto community who are living on faith that their entire fuel source is the smell of faith as a petrol. That's what's keeping them going, because at this point, we don't have mass adoption. We don't have you can't pay with Bitcoin and get your coffee at Starbucks yet. And until that day happens, we are living on faith, and literally we're living on fumes. And nobody wants to be told they're wrong. But I have to say, as a pragmatic, FI, frugal person who likes investing and is willing to see something for what it's worth, somebody's got to call it out and say, hold on a second. Before you jump ship into this thing, you might make a lot of money, but you might lose your shirt. And when they're $10,000 of Bitcoin, I don't want to be anywhere near the blast range on this.
You know, Brad, we have done over 100 episodes on this podcast, and you know that I am the first person to jump in and interrupt, but you, I'm sure you could sense, I was like, I'm just going to sit back and let Miles run with it.
Yeah, that was fantastic, Miles. And I think you hit it right on the head with the speculative behavior, and that's why there's that reflexive revulsion from people in the FI community, I think specifically, because we look at this and you hear people who really know essentially nothing, calling it an investment. And to me, like, it doesn't fit any of the definitions of an investment. It's right now, it seems to be speculation. But I'm actually curious, if you don't mind, because this is like a rare opportunity to talk to somebody who really does know a whole heck of a lot about cryptocurrencies in general. To go back to the point of inception, right? Bitcoin, or really this speaks to any of these other hundreds or thousands of cryptocurrencies. What makes one of these things worth anything? And this is not tongue in cheek. I'm not trying to be put it down in any way. I just mean, like, there are 1,000 cryptocurrencies. What differentiates any of them? What makes them have any type of inherent value? Like, I like to use a quote from Tim Ferriss is, what would this look like if it were easy? And to me, that's like, what would it look like if Bitcoin were not under this speculative bubble? And okay, there's eventually going to be 21 million of these coins. What are they worth? Like, how do we peg what they're worth? Does it go up in some normal fashion? Like, if it's actually used as a currency, what does it even look like? And how do we know why there's any inherent value? Is it just that we're all using it? Is that what gives it value? I guess, talk me through that, because that is what fascinates me.
Well, Bitcoin, in its original white paper, is just simply a peer-to-peer method of transferring value over the internet between parties. And I used it for that. That was my primary purpose. So I'm very true to the original intention of the white paper. But in effect, it has three, what we call network effects. It has three network effects. One is that it's a medium of exchange, so I can transfer value. The second is it's a store of value, in that it has some inherent perceived value converted to, say, US dollars, what we value a Bitcoin as. And then the final one is it's a record of trust in a public ledger. And those three things need to be achieved in order for Bitcoin to reach its, you know, to reach a point where people use it and it's just a part of our normal lives. I would say that if those three things were achieved, this could disrupt world currencies forever. That's a really great faith-based position. And people value Bitcoin because A, it's scarce, and B, they don't want to miss out. They want to be on that train, right? But if we really pragmatically look at the reality of 2018 and Bitcoin, all of those three factors, except for the final one, the record of trust, the blockchain, they're not achieved. As a medium of exchange, it requires customers and vendors to accept it. And very few are doing that. And that's because as more and more people got involved in this, it didn't scale well, not like Visa or MasterCard does. And the costs of doing the transactions became so prohibitive that stores that used to accept Bitcoin shut down and stopped accepting it. So as a medium of exchange, didn't work, right? That one's off the table. As a store of value, then people used to think of Bitcoin as like gold 2.0. Right. This is like gold that you can transfer and you can store electronically and digitally, and it's great and it's better than gold. Well, it's not. And the reason is when volatility affects an asset, all of a sudden the value of the asset depletes. So if I, for example, if I put $1,000 into gold, there is a pretty good chance 12 months later that I'm going to go back and I'm going to have my gold and I'll sell it and I might get maybe $1,050, maybe $1,100, maybe $950, but it's going to be close to what I put in. You know, it's a safe haven. If I do the same with Bitcoin, well, you know, depends what time of the year. If I did, if I bought Bitcoin at $15,000 in December and I come to it today and it's now $10,000, well, I've lost a huge percentage of my asset and it no longer has that, you know, store of value property. That said, I could do it in reverse. I could buy it at $1,000 and then come back to it 12 months later and it's $15,000 and it's a wonderful store of value, but there's no guarantee. And the volatility is what scares people off and again, reduces the adoption rate. So the more times we fail in any of these network effects, the more time Bitcoin becomes less and less of a probable currency. Add to that the mass hysteria that we saw in 2017, where you had sites like BitConnect, which was like a Ponzi scheme thing where people could buy into it with a bunch of money. And then there were all these guys on YouTube talking about how much money they're going to, you know, the Ferraris they're buying and the Lambos and the houses and the, you know, it was just nuts. People were just out of control. And it just showed me human greed at its worst. And how people just got scammed. And then when that site went down and everybody lost their shirt and everybody lost their money, rather than people saying, well, investments have risks or speculations have risks and sometimes they don't work out, okay, dust myself off and move on. No, they all went to lawyers and got class action suits and then started to sue the very same YouTube hosts who are out there selling it. This is what happens in boom and bust. The worst of humanity comes forward and everybody thinks they're Gordon Gekko. And, you know, it's horrible. When I saw this happening, I looked back in history at 1865 California Gold Rush, and I studied what happened from historical record and how that all came about. And it's so interesting because it's so parallel to this. When they discovered gold in California, only a few people found out about it. And those people made enormous amounts of wealth because they found this thing that very few people, and eventually the word got out. And then all of a sudden, everybody from the dust bowls of Oklahoma and Texas all went west in search of their fortune. And they all, you know, hit upon places like San Francisco, which at the time, the only, you know, should we say, police enforcement that was there was the military, who were just there as a sort of a, you know, watch and see type thing. And there were basically no laws. Anything could happen. So people went in there and they're panning and they're sluicing and they're doing everything they can to get gold out of the ground. And some of those early adopters, they made a lot of money. But then the gold ran out. And what happened when the gold ran out is all of a sudden, guess what? People started stealing from each other. You get gunfights in the street because people were anxious and they were upset. And then all of the crime didn't happen. And we had this sort of lawlessness that came across this scarcity of resource and too many people getting in, fighting over it. And it felt like 2017. And then what happened was, this is the irony of it all. The original Bitcoin and its mantra was to be decentralized, never controlled by a central authority, a government, an enforcement force, anything like that. Well, that's wonderful in a purist, you know, anarcho kind of world. But when resources go scarce and you have no governance, then people go out of control with crime and the whole bit. And guess what they do? I mean, I draw the simple analogy, like me and my family go out for dinner one night, right? And we come home and somebody's broken into the house. They've ransacked everything. They've stolen everything they can in sight. What's the first thing that you do? Call the police. You reach out to a third party to be the enforcer to act on your behalf to try to right that wrong. Well, the entire community, the libertarian anarchist community that was behind things like Bitcoin and the original blockchain back in the day, didn't want governance. They don't want that sort of thing. And so what we've got is this kind of Wild West mentality in which 1865 repeats itself all over again. People start turning to crime in order to get money. There's this mass rush to get crypto before it goes up too high, and it never ends well.
You know, that revulsion you mentioned, I think 2017 is the first year I ever felt that. When I was literally getting stock tips from the Shoeshine Boys, to quote Joseph Kennedy during the Great Depression, it's literally people that have never had an interest in investing were suddenly coming up asking me whether Bitcoin should be their very first investment. You could feel it. You knew it was going south. You just had this kind of creepy sensation over your shoulder. And I think you have set the playing field in a perfect place for us. And I think every single minute up to this point has been value added. But if we could, I would love to take a few minutes and just hit you with some questions. These are genuine questions from our community. They're questions that Brad and I have had as well. And taking what I would say is, from your end, a very friendly face to the Bitcoin community and also getting where the FI community is coming from, I would love it if you could kind of help us work through a few of these questions that I know all of us have. And frankly, we're just trying to figure out where to get a straight answer. Would you be willing to take a few questions?
Bring it forward. Okay. Let's do it.
So my first question would be one, like, why are we talking about Bitcoin and not about PayPal? You know, you mentioned PayPal earlier. You said you couldn't get it to Bangladesh. Okay, makes sense. But generally speaking, there's mass hysteria around Bitcoin and the future of Bitcoin and the future of blockchain. PayPal's been around forever, and it feels like it fits a lot of those requirements. Why do we not discuss PayPal in the same way?
Well, firstly, I mean, in my particular case, it was because of reciprocal banking agreements not existing in regions I wanted to trade. But for the most part, there's no reason why you can't use PayPal to buy whatever you want. I mean, we use it to buy our eBay purchases all the time. I see no reason why it isn't a reasonable alternative. It comes down to cost competitiveness. If Bitcoin can do something for pennies on a transaction and PayPal wants dollars, well, I'm going to go where my money's treated best. But in this case, you know, I don't think Bitcoin's achieving that at this point. So I still think, see PayPal as a very viable way of sending money over the internet, as long as the recipient is willing, is able and willing to receive it.
One of the things about Bitcoin that to me has always seemed like a real limitation is the artificial scarcity. You know, you say it's capped at 21 million. Well, what happens when all of those have been mined and it goes from there? So, you know, and this is from Daniel, and he basically, I think he was citing actually the Mustache article that you mentioned earlier, and he said, inflation, at least at a small level, can be good. It's needed in order to expand the supply in goods and services. And I think going back to that Mustache quote, and also something that J.L. Collins mentioned, when you don't have that, what you end up with is deflation and hoarding. And in fact, I would say even in your case, when I think about what you have right now, you didn't want to spend the Bitcoin that you had. You actually brought new money to the table in order to exchange that. That way you could hoard or invest the Bitcoin that you actually had. What does that mean for the future of the currency?
Well, it comes down to trust. Bitcoin is limited in scarcity and controlled as far as it's the miners control new coins, which enters the economy based on a scale. And that scale depletes over time. So the assumption was in the original design that Moore's law, which is that computing power kind of doubles every 18 months or so, would continue to play out, and that as a result of that, the Bitcoin reward system would halve every couple of years, or 4 years, I think it is. And as a result, it naturally controls itself from an inflation deflation perspective, somewhat. But at some point, we don't really know what its actual price point is to be able to gauge that. It comes down to adoption and faith at this point. And that's what's driven its price up, you know, north of $10,000. And we don't know when this is going to end. So I can't say, look, it's a bad idea, never go near it, because tomorrow it could be worth 50,000. It could. There's absolute reason for that. If Bitcoin only takes 1% of the world's gold reserves as a digital gold, it's worth 28 grand right there, just 1%. But it comes down to, you've got to be able to spend it too. And the other thing which plays to its favor is that when you look at the value of a US dollar over time, its buying power is horrible. If I take what was able to be purchased with $1 30 years ago and I compare it with today, well, it's obvious how diluted the dollar has become. And the more that we have Federal Reserves injecting money into the supply to dilute down the value of the purchasing power of the dollars we already have, then I would be very, very worried if I was somebody who was on the path to FI, worked for 10 years, saved everything that I've got a couple of $1 million in assets, and I put it in equities and real estate and cash and gold and whatever, only to find out that the value, the purchasing power of that $2 million 10 years from now, when I need to be able to use it, is diminished so much that I basically have to go back and become a greeter at Walmart. I mean, no. That's not a good thing. And I know that's an extreme case, but it has to be factored into the return percentages we're looking at for investments, whether it be in index funds, whether it be in real estate. All these things are being affected by the pure value of what a US dollar is. And if you have a central reserve that is controlling that currency and is influenced with lower interest rates, and you know they're penalizing savers in order to support borrowers, to me it's obvious why Bitcoin's so popular. I mean, if that's the alternative, yeah, give me Bitcoin. But I'm not sure if Bitcoin is jumping from the frying pan into the fire.
Miles, I'm curious, and this kind of ties into a question I had before and what Jonathan just asked, maybe about like the outstanding number of Bitcoins and who controls these things and how many are actually being used to purchase items. I read something that, I guess, Satoshi Nakamoto, who is, I guess, which is a fake name, unknown person or people, let's say, who created Bitcoin has somewhere in the vicinity of a million of these coins of like the 16 million that exist. And I read another article that the founder of Ripple, which is evidently one of the other main cryptocurrencies, in January was worth about $60 billion, which is more than Zuckerberg or, you know, pretty close to Warren Buffett. And to me, it's just such an odd thing that basically this guy created a fictional currency, took 20% of it or whatever the amount was, and all of a sudden he's worth $60 billion. On what planet is that possible? What's the value that he's creating to the world? I guess that's what I'm missing at its essence. And like, I'd just love to hear your thoughts on that.
Well, there's a lot of historical precedent on this. Back in 1976, there used to be a group of computer hobbyists in San Francisco that were, that all got together, and they were, the group was called the Homebrew Computer Club. And these are, you know, ragtag hippies that got a soldering iron and worked out that they wanted to have a computer because they didn't want the big government departments to be the only ones with computers. And back in those days, I mean, these were true nerds, real nerds. What happened was that this is where Steve Jobs and Steve Wozniak came from. And I remember that a letter was written from this kid who lived up in the North Pacific Northwest to this group because he had been writing software and he was worried that this group were giving away his software, which had no value because all they were focused on was the hardware, the machines, the chips, the resistors, the capacitors, the stuff they were soldering and working and showing to their friends, right? And this kid said, look, you know, software takes effort. It takes labor and energy, and I should get paid for this, right? Well, that was, software was never a thing. And back in those days, software was an intangible, and people only trusted something they could physically touch in their hands. Well, that kid went on to be Bill Gates, and he became the richest man in the world. He knew that intangible assets would become a thing, and he created an empire around that. There's so many points in history where you could go back and see this happening, whether it be in, say, the newspaper industry or in automobiles. I mean, this is how things work. And what we might not perceive to have value today may, in fact, have enormous value in the future. It's just who perceives that value and whether that perception becomes reality.
So I think this conversation has several forks in it. I think we started by talking about utility and currency, and we're doing a few questions from our community right now. I think that after these questions, it might make sense just to talk just for a few minutes about, for someone that today is day one and they're saying, okay, I'm interested in Bitcoin, where do I get started? I think we should talk through the pros and the cons of it as an investment. But before we get there, at least maybe two more questions, one from me and one from Brad. And this came from our Facebook group, and it's William's question, and I'm just going to read it. He says, I'm constantly struck by how many people are excited about Bitcoin and crypto trading in general without knowing the IRS requirements on taxation of that activity. It seems that most people seem perfectly willing to ignore their tax obligation or think that as long as they don't cash into a fiat currency, their gains are deferred. But in reality, every transaction, whether it goes through fiat or not, is a taxable event, and you're responsible for tracking the cost basis between currencies in terms of US dollars and paying the taxes on the gains associated with the trades. Also, if you're mining, the earning of Bitcoins is treated as income, which is taxed in the year in which the payment is issued. Talk about a tax bomb, man. Can you talk for a few minutes? Do you know anybody that either had to report an earnings or a loss on a taxable event? It sounds like based on what you did over the last year, you didn't really have this as much because you did instant transactions. You didn't sell Bitcoin that you've been holding previously. What are your thoughts on this?
Well, the laws changed. Okay, well, firstly, you know, I'm not a CPA. Talk to your CPA about all this sort of stuff. Now, let me tell you my opinion. Prior to January the 1st, the IRS issued their entire legislation on this was basically like a page and a half FAQ on cryptocurrency. We want to treat it as an asset. That was their position. That still is their position. And as a result of an asset, you create a taxable event when you convert an asset to US dollars, in effect. So if you have Bitcoin and you never leave the crypto space with it, and that includes other currencies as well, like Litecoin, Ethereum, and Dash or whatever, and you're transferring within the crypto space, but you never actually convert to US dollars, prior to January the 1st, that did not constitute a taxable event. At least that's what myself and my accountant and my tax attorneys understand the situation to be. when they passed the tax reform bill in the end of last year, they added a couple of very, very small little changes to wording in legislation that does not that now says if you convert a cryptocurrency asset of one type to another cryptocurrency asset of a different type, that's a taxable event. And the only exception to that would be like a transfer, like a 1031 exchange, which was explicitly written into the tax code as being non-taxable within the boundaries of, say, a real estate transaction like a 1031. But anything else, you're going to be paying tax on it. That means that people are going to have to pay tax on these transactions from January the 1st, 2018 going forward. Prior to that, I guess the old rules apply. One thing that is a misunderstanding with Bitcoin is that people think it's a private, anonymous currency. No one can trace Bitcoin. Wrong. That's absolutely wrong. The blockchain, which is the public ledger, shows every transaction to and from by wallet address, and you can easily trace it. The question is, who owns the wallet for the to? Who owns the wallet for the from? And you can use various forensic techniques to work that out. And if you're using some of the exchanges like Coinbase or whatever, you'll probably find the address that you've got is consistent. It's used for every transaction, whether you're receiving or sending. And those exchanges are having to comply with financial crimes and enforcement network law. And they're going to give up that information about who owns what wallet address. And then guess what? Every transaction you did is in the public space and it's totally visible and you're going to get found. So pay your taxes. It's okay. Pay your taxes. Do it honestly and you'll be fine. If you think that you can get away with some sort of crazy hack or some sort of crazy using 15 different addresses here and there and you're no better off than a malware troll out there trying to get money, fine, you can try that. But ultimately, you'll get caught. You will. It's just the way the world works. And at the end of the day, it's easier just to understand the laws and pay your taxes and work within it. And what's likely negative of people who are thinking they can get away with these transactions and trying to remain anonymous is that we may find ourselves in a situation where we have to register every wallet address with the US government against your social security number, for example, so that they can go back and look at the public blockchain and audit everything. And at that point, all financial privacy is out the door. So if you want to do the right thing, it's going to help keep the status quo as it is. But, hey, not everyone wants to do the right thing, right?
Miles, I'm going to combine a similar question from both John and Frank. And they basically said, is there any reason to think that more than one or two cryptocurrencies will survive? How do we know which ones will end up being the equivalent of Facebook or Google and which ones will go the way of MySpace and Alta Vista? Like, how would we even approach the thousands of cryptocurrencies, try to make heads or tails of what has value, what might still exist 10 years from now?
Well, economics and history will answer that question quite well. I mean, you typically find in a marketplace when there might be 10 competitors in the market that eventually the market weeds itself out and you have one guy who owns 50% of the market and then maybe two or three others that own the rest. And that's kind of how it plays. It's kind of like Coke and Pepsi and then there's a couple of others. But for the most part, there are just, it comes down to a minimum number of competing options or products in that space. I think the same will apply eventually in the crypto space. The currencies that are out there, I mean, it's mind-boggling to see 1,000 cryptocurrencies online and all their prices moving. And to anybody new, they're going to look at it and go, I threw my arms up in the air. I've got no idea. What are these things? Most of them are, there's a term in the crypto space called ICOs or initial coin offerings. It's a trick that basically it's sort of like Kickstarter. You've got somebody out there who has this brilliant idea that they want to create a new, maybe it's a voting system on the blockchain, for example. But in order to do that, they need money because they want to get developers and they want to do it right. And so they create this slick looking website and a bunch of videos and they put a bunch of people's names up there that you might have heard of. And they go, we're looking for investors to come in and buy initial coin offerings in our thing, and we're going to go live, and this stuff's going to go through the moon, and you early adopters, you're going to make out like bazillionaires. No. Firstly, that securities is probably going to be shut down by the SEC, because you can't do that under law. Now, some of those will be offshore. They're not part of US. They're, you know, housed in Pakistan or the UK or somewhere like that. Okay, yeah, it's going to be hard to shut them down. But at the end of the day, that's just another coin offering that sits on the list that you could be bamboozled into buying. You know, then you've got pump and dump scams on these things. And at the end of the day, it's the Wild West. And who knows what's going to be the next big thing. What I look at is, show me the white paper. Show me what you're trying to do. Does this have real world application? Does it have a market that will spend money for it? And is it something that's real, tangible, and likely to occur, just like any other startup that you might want to be an investor in? You have to apply due diligence exactly the same way. And by the time you do that, 99% of those ICOs and those coins disappear, because they have no actual real value. What you end up with is a handful, and typically it's Bitcoin, Ethereum, Litecoin, Dash, Monero. I'm sure there's a few others in there that you could add. I would argue Ripple is not a good idea, because it's not a decentralized cryptocurrency. It's a controlled cryptocurrency. It's basically bank coin, and I'm not a fan of that, because I think that the whole reason there's attractiveness in this market is because people don't trust central authorities and they want a truly decentralized currency. So to me, I could whittle down the options to 4 or 5, really. And full disclosure, I own all of them.
I guess we probably should ask what 4 or 5 that you're interested in. But I think even more than that, stop me if you heard this before, but what I usually end up hearing as I get into why someone is interested in Bitcoin, inevitably at some point I hear, oh yeah, yeah. But if you don't invest in it, you know, it's not that it's Bitcoin, it's the blockchain. It's important to invest in the blockchain because that's the future. And I'm skeptical right out the gate, because the person most likely, and this is maybe my own bias, has no idea what blockchain is. This is just basically reciting something else they've read somewhere else. But then my next thought that follows that immediately is, yeah, but you're not investing in blockchain, you're investing in Bitcoin. And I think while that may be the go-to for why everybody should be doing this, those two aren't exactly the same. And I'm curious, one, if you agree with my analysis of that. And then two, if someone says, I think blockchain is the future and I want to invest in blockchain, what would that actually look like?
Okay. Well, I wouldn't say that you're investing in blockchain. What you're doing is investing in companies that wish to use blockchain in the same way that we use the electricity grid, or we use currency, or we use air, or a basic raw material, because the blockchain is pretty much a raw material. I mean, its job is to allow truth to be written and to persist and not ever be altered. And when you think about it, if that's all blockchain is doing, in terms of it's being mined and validated, it's about a record of truth. There's never been a time in human history where having a record of truth is so important, because we've all experienced, you know, how we don't know who to trust. We don't know who's telling us the truth. We don't know what to believe in what newspaper and what comes out of what politician's mouth. All this stuff is, there's no ultimate validation of truth. The blockchain gives us that. It gives us something that can't be changed. It persists, and it's wonderful. So you have to think of it that way. How could that be applied in society, in commerce, in politics, in communications? There are so many applications. If somebody says, I want to invest in the blockchain, I ask, and in what way are you investing in something in which the blockchain is being used? And at that point, there is no answer. So what they will do is they'll say, well, if the blockchain is Ethereum, because really, so the blockchain, there are two effective ways of looking at it. One is as a public record of truth, which is probably the most noble use, and that would be to utilize technologies like Ethereum, which can support that sort of thing. And then you've got this thing called private blockchains, which is kind of what the banks want to have so that they can do interbank trusted transactions and so on, which to me is like, why don't you just use SSL? Why don't you just, you know, encrypt your communication over the internet? And then, but no, they want to do this thing because it's a buzzword and everybody wants to be in on it. And they think that there's a career in software development if you use blockchain on your resume or something. I mean, that's, we've come to that again. And a lot of it's hype and a lot of it's just blown up. And yes, there will be changes in the way society works as a result of having a persistent record of truth that cannot be changed. This will affect us in so many different ways. There's so many opportunities that come from that. But there is not one killer app yet. There is not one application of that which you can put your, you can hang your hat on and say, yeah, there's that which uses the blockchain. Not that it comes and affects our lives every single day. My take on it is that the blockchain is likely to be something that is under the foundation of what people use, kind of like open source is in software, and that it will be a great way to empower new applications and new opportunities and new technology. But it as of itself should be behind the curtain. You don't see it, and it's kind of like power, and you don't think about it anymore. You just need to know that this thing is built on a public blockchain. That's all you need to know. And if that's the case, investing in it, it's kind of like investing in power or investing in, you know, air or investing in water. We need it. It's got to be there. But I'm not sure if there's something investable.
Last question. Decentralization. If Bitcoin or one of the competitive cryptocurrencies truly had mass adoption, how could it possibly hope to stay decentralized?
It comes down to mining. And I mean, that would be very complicated to explain with the time we have on the podcast, but it's all about validation by consensus. And that if, as long as you've got a lot of parties involved in mining something, that they can, as a community, kind of crowdsource a perspective on something by using mathematics or the same mathematics to validate that, that this is fact and this exists and it's true and we all agree on it. And that's the way the blockchain works. You can't put something on the blockchain which is a change of something that happened historically without all the miners kicking it out. You won't get confirmed transactions that way, and so therefore it self-polices. The power of decentralization is enormous, absolutely enormous. It is truly life-changing, and it is, there are so many aspects of history in which it's proven to be the ultimate winner. One of those, there's a book which I would encourage anybody interested in this subject, has nothing to do with Bitcoin, but it's so important to read. And I believe it's called The Starfish and the Spider. Find that book. It talks about history. It talks to the way the Spanish conquered Mexico. And that, that when the Spanish came in, they were able to conquer Mexico quickly because they found a king at the top of the tree. And by taking the king out, the country fell to Spain. It was so easy. But when they went north and they came into areas like Arizona, where there were tribes of indigenous Native Americans who worked in a networked model, there were lots of little tribes, the Spanish could not conquer the region because every time they attempted to take a tribe out with their massive army, 15 other tribes would come and get them from the flank. And then how did it work? Well, each tribe communicated in a network model with each other. And ultimately, there was no centralized point that you could secure to take over something. This is so important when it comes to economics. If there's a central reserve, a central government, a central authority, you have a central place to attack. But in a network model, and this is how the internet works, it's impervious to a Cold War attack because it's a distributed set of nodes that if you can't route traffic from one point to another, it's okay. It works its way around it. Just like a tribe of marauded, you know, Native Americans out there taking on this massive army from the Spain and winning.
I see your point, but I want to play devil's advocate just because in my mind, this is how I would see it playing out. Like, I agree with everything you said. I get that. That analogy is perfect. But let's say that the government viewed a decentralized currency as a threat. and they just outright ban it. They don't need to bring it into the fold. They just need to say that it is illegal to use this currency. And if you do so, you are doing so outside the realm of the law. You pointed to earlier how we all run to the government as soon as something goes wrong. Well, it works the other way as well. And I guess we see that. We actually have examples of countries either outright banning it or talking about passing legislation. And I'm just wondering, are we past the point in this tiny little world where we have Echoes and Alexas that listen to our every word, and we have, you know, we're so much farther past that Big Brother type book. Are we past the point where something that's truly decentralized could ever even exist?
No, I don't think so. Remember, the internet is international. It's not the realm of one country. It's the world. Everybody participates openly on the internet. And that helps police it, because you might have one totalitarian regime that decides it wants to block the internet or censor the internet or put the great firewall up on the internet or whatever. But that's fine, because everyone just routes around them and they don't participate. And the downside of them not participating is they can become an island unto themselves, and then nobody can trade with them, and they can't influence the behavior of everybody else because they've cut themselves off from it. And I think the same is true when it comes to cryptocurrencies. There are countries out there that are, you know, jailing people for using Bitcoin, that are banning it, that are threatened by it. And when you look at it, I say just as many countries that are doing that, there are other countries. Japan is a great example of this, in which Japan said, you know what, this could be a competitive advantage to us. So we're going to go ahead and we're going to be Bitcoin friendly, and we're going to have regulation, but they're going to be light touch. And we're going to go in there and we're going to force innovation. We're going to have our people develop the next economy. And we're going to have 4,500 retailers in Tokyo who will accept Bitcoin at a point of sale. And all of a sudden, Japan is, you know, the United States looks to Japan and goes, do we want to compete with that? Should we black ban this thing, or should we keep it, or what do we want to do? And then meanwhile, you know, similar laws in Mexico, for example, are being written, in which Mexico can see a way of bringing families out of poverty, out of being unbanked, and giving them access to cryptocurrencies in order to raise their standards. And this is right on our doorstep. If we just shut down and we regulate everything, we are going to have our lunch eaten for us by these other countries. And look, that might be something Russia, for example, wants to do, and it might be something China decides it wants to do. That's fine. But do we want to get the same results that they get, or do we want to try and outthink them, out-innovate them, and create something better for the future? And the United States, and my discussions I've had with people in FinCEN and to be honest, in other areas, would say it's more likely that they would want to monitor and just keep a watch on it and be light touch, at least for the next few years, because what could come out of that could be enormous for the future. Now, they're not going to go too far. They're not going to allow terrorists to win and all that sort of thing. But at the end of the day, if the blockchain, particularly in Bitcoin, can be watched and monitored, maybe they're okay with that. I don't know.
We got a message from Michael, and he says, I hope you'll convey to the audience why we should be excited about blockchain just generally, and in particular, instant payments for claims such as delayed flights through smart contracts and finance, expanding banking and lending to the other half of the world that doesn't have access, identification and credit worthiness that crosses all applications, being able to basically bridge this gap. One of the things that he pointed out was the limitation specifically of Bitcoin. I doubt any true FI enthusiast would be excited to buy their first $100 in Bitcoin only to find that it'll cost them $5 to $60 for the privilege to spend or transfer the Bitcoin. And he says this is why Bitcoin is fading in its usefulness as a currency, and why other cryptocurrencies and blockchain 2.0 technologies are much more exciting and promising in their applications. So with that in mind, as we close, I would love, one, to hear if you have any feedback or thoughts on Michael's statements, and then two, maybe what 1 to 5 cryptocurrencies you have your eye on going into the next several years.
I think the biggest challenge that any cryptocurrency or any blockchain technology has is to convince people to use it. It comes down to being aware of it. This is not a topic that you can have a conversation in 20 words or less over. It requires somebody to have the willingness to dig a little deeper and learn a little bit about it. And whereas that has already been achieved to some level with Bitcoin and there's some momentum, Bitcoin has become the canary in the coal mine with cryptocurrencies. When Bitcoin wins, it raises all of the boats with it, right? And when Bitcoin loses, you look at those valuations on every other cryptocurrency and they go down as well. And that's not because technologically it's inferior, superior, or equal to. And Michael's right. It is technologically inferior to most of the other currencies that have come from it, afwards. But it's about awareness. People know what Bitcoin is. There's Bitcoin ticker symbols on CNBC. People understand that it might not be perfect, but it's understood and there's market awareness. And having said that, here's the reason why I think it's still profoundly important is because protocols are not flat two-dimensional things where you've got like one currency which does one thing, this currency does that thing, and this currency does that thing. In technology, we live in a world of leverage. What that means is that you build on top of somebody who came before you. When I want to create new software, I don't have to build a compiler. When I want to build a new computer, I don't have to solder chips. They're already there. I just assemble from what was there before me and I make it better. And I continue that process going up and up. We see this even in banking. If I go to buy a coffee at Starbucks, I'm not transferring money from my bank account to the vendor's bank account in real time at high expense and waiting for it to happen. I'm using what we would refer to as a layer two technology, and that is merchant processing like Visa and MasterCard, which will instantaneously do the transaction and 72 hours later will remit to the vendor the money. Bitcoin has exactly that same future ahead of it because of things called side chains and particularly a technology called the Lightning Network. I cannot stress how important the Lightning Network will be to Bitcoin's future. Its success should denote Bitcoin's success because it enables commerce to happen in real time and it enables Bitcoin to cut through all of the objections which stopped it succeeding in its other network effects. That's what I've got my eye on very, very closely. Meanwhile, Michael is right. The blockchain technologies, particularly in areas like Ethereum with decentralized apps and smart contracts, those things Bitcoin cannot do. But at the end of the day, there's some things the US dollar can't do, and there's always room for yen and Deutschmark and you know pesos and whatever else. There's room for everybody to have a piece of this pie. The problem right now is it doesn't have to be a one wins, everybody loses. It's a combination of things, and ultimately it's going to get weeded out probably by regulation. And if I was looking at where a regulator would be looking to focus attention, they're probably going to say, if we take on Bitcoin, which has such great mass adoption, it's going to be an uphill climb, but maybe we don't need XYZ coin because, you know, we don't know what that's for, so we'll regulate that out. I think there is room here for blockchain technologies to exist as blockchain technologies and away from currency-based things. They don't all have to be monetized. But there's also a lot of value in the fact that we already have marketing name recognition for Bitcoin, and it is truly the canary in the coal mine.
Miles, thank you so much for coming on the show for your second time, man.
Yeah, I know. Returning guest. Well, thank you, guys. I appreciate it. I think one of the things I really do appreciate is that we got an opportunity to see both sides of the coin, you know, both the Bitcoin maximalist position, but also the no-coiner position. And it's funny, we live in a world where everything's polarized, right? It's true or false, it's right or left, it's us or them. It doesn't have to be like that. There are answers sitting in between everything. I always like the Robert Kiyosaki principle of, you know, he would always say, what side of the coin are you on? Was it heads or tails? And he'd go, neither, I'm on the edge. I want to be able to sit on the edge and see both sides of the coin. And I think when it comes to things like cryptocurrency, we are spectators on a train moving forward at a rapid speed. And whether you enjoy the ride or you don't, it's rocky. It's a roller coaster ride. Some people can handle it. Some people can't. That's okay. This is what changing the future looks like. And at the end of the day, when you're trying to equate it into financial dollars, is it going to affect my retirement, my FI journey? Am I going to make $1 million doing this sort of thing? I don't think anybody's got the answer to that. I think like anything in a technological revolution, if you find yourself at the right place and the right time, be at least aware that you're there. and at least be willing to have an open mind. And that's what happened to me when I started off on this thing. I had an open mind, but I know this journey has to come to an end at some point. I have to get off this train. And so I'm going to pick my point where I exit and I cash out. But right now I'm still sitting at the table and having a good old time with it. But it just, you know, I'm not sure of all the people who have come to the table since me, and I'm not really sure what's going on. But at some point, I know I'll cash out and I'll get out of this thing. But man, it's wonderful being a witness to this sort of, you know, evolution.
The table got kind of crowded last year.
It sure did.
You know, Brad, at a very selfish level, the reason that I wanted to do this particular episode was so that when that individual that has never shown any interest in investing comes to me and says, should I invest in Bitcoin? I can just say, hey, go listen to this episode, take it all in, and then make up your own mind. You know, because that's what we see over and over again. And frankly, I think that's what Miles brought to the table today. This was an incredibly comprehensive and concise intro to the conversation of cryptos, both as a currency and as a speculative investment.
Yeah, I mean, just as someone who likes to learn new things, this was a very informative episode. And it served the purpose that we wanted, which was we're not looking to get clickbait here or make some kind of us against them. This is just Miles coming on, trying to give us some background that he's picked up over the last 6 or 7 years, as he was a real early adopter in this for the right reasons, right? Based on utility. And I find that fascinating as his initial foray into cryptocurrencies and Bitcoin specifically. So yeah, I mean, Jonathan, obviously that was kind of tongue in cheek about, hey, should I invest in Bitcoin if someone comes to me? And I mean, that's difficult, right? Because a lot of what we've seen here and what Miles talked about, a lot of this is speculative behavior in 2017 and now into 2018. And that's a separate animal entirely. I think Miles was really trying to explain to us the underlying technology, why there may be inherent value in some of this, and what the utility might be going forward. And that's what I find interesting. So I still have a difficult time separating it between the herd mentality that's going on now and that underlying utility and like what that actually looks like 10, 20, 50 years from now. But I believe there's a real significant opportunity here, and we need to be open-minded. And that's the crucial part, is don't close your mind to anything. Just try to understand what's going on. And then you make the decision, yes or no, this makes sense for my life, and move forward with some information.
All right, to our audience, I hope you got value from this episode. I hope you've been getting value from all the episodes up to this point. If you want to support us and what we're doing here at Choose FI, here are 4 easy ways. 1, leave us an iTunes review. If you want to do that, just go to chooseify.com/iTunes. 2, use our page to sign up for travel credit cards. If you want to travel the world with miles and points instead of your hard-earned dollars, then just go to chooseify.com/cards and get started today. 3, if you're working on the milestones of FI, set up a personal capital account to track your progress and use our affiliate link. It's completely free, and just go to chooseFI.com/PC. P as in Paul, C as in cat. And 4, and most importantly, find your friends, coworkers, and family members who might be open to this message and tell them about the podcast. Have them start with episode 38, The Why of FI, and right behind that, have them go listen to episode 21, The Pillars of FI. It is a fantastic starting place. All right, my friends, the fire is spreading. We'll see you next time as we continue to go down the road less traveled.
You've been listening to Choose FI Radio Podcast, where we help middle-class America build wealth, one life hack at a time.